You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The banking crisis began in August of 2007, and now, just 2 years later, the New York Times reports that taxpayers have begun seeing profits from the hundreds of billions of dollars in aid given to banks. The profits amount to $4 billion, or the equivalent of about 15% annually. But before anyone celebrates, this news has to be seen in the context of the failure of 84 banks in 2009 alone. To make sense of this and more, we turn to Henry Kaufman, nicknamed Dr. Doom for his consistently bearish views on the markets. He's called his latest book, which is fiercely critical of the American financial industry, The Road to Financial Reformation, Warnings, Consequences, Reforms. It is published by Wiley & Sons, and I'm pleased that it brings Dr. Kaufman to our show today. Welcome.
Well, thank you very much.
One thing I noticed in the New York Times article is that of the 8 big banks who have repaid their loan amounts, there's a gap in the coverage because these same banks received AIG bailout money as well. So why isn't more made of how many banks received AIG money?
Well, the AIG money was very important because financial institutions of very large size are interconnected. And therefore, if one major institution would fail and fall, the result would be really a serious collapse in the financial system as a whole.
But what I'm saying is I'm not sure whether we're just not handing it to AIG and then getting it back through the people AIG owed money to.
Well, I don't think we will get all of it back for the very simple reason there were significant losses, and those losses have to be taken. They will be socialized to a large extent.
The Times article also suggested that if we included the profits generated by Citigroup and Bank of America, the American taxpayer would have an additional $18 billion. But Citigroup and Bank of America aren't in a position to pay back their loans. So what do these profits mean in the long run?
Well, these profits mean in the long run that perhaps over time a lot of this money can be paid back, but probably not all of it. The fact is that the accommodation by the federal government to these very large institutions has been much, much more.
And then the Washington Post reported recently that the record number of bank failures has created an opportunity for some banks that were deemed too big to fail to get bigger.
Well, now you've pointed out something that's very crucial. The fact is, in the last two decades or so, and even earlier, we've had a significant consolidation of our financial institutions, especially in the last two decades, and especially since the Glass-Steagall Act somehow died in the 1990s.
Somehow died? Wasn't it killed?
Well, it was killed in a sense when no overt action was taken by Congress or no complaints were launched by these various regulators, especially the Federal Reserve, and that demise of Glass-Steagall encouraged a massive consolidation of our financial system, especially the consolidation accelerated during this crisis, which is now called the Great Recession.
And now we have J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, and Citigroup issuing one out of every two mortgages and about two of every three credit cards. So they're pretty much, this small group of institutions is pretty much dominating the field.
Well, that is exactly right. The critical issue before our government and before Congress is how to deal with these very large institutions, what legislation ought to be passed, and what kind of reformation will take place.
We have another. J.P. Morgan Chase now holds more than $1 of every $10 in deposit in this country, and Bank of America has pretty much the same. So that means the two banks have one-fifth of all of the money in the United States?
Yes, the 10 largest financial institutions in the United States probably today hold over 50% of all financial assets in the country.
So if most people agree that killing Glass-Steagall was a mistake, Why is this continuing to happen?
Well, we were in an environment over the last practically two decades in which there was the philosophy carried out by our governments and by the Federal Reserve and the other regulators that those who prosper will, those who do well will prosper, those who do poorly will fail. However, that was not allowed to prevail when it comes to very large institutions. And therefore, a policy was followed that I would call asymmetrical, meaning you pursue substantial accommodation during periods of ease, but at the same time, when we get into periods of restraint, you don't allow the restraint to unfold.
Well, were we prepared for this? The FDIC reports the lowest amount of funds in reserve it's had in many years.
No, we were not prepared. None of the regulators were prepared, starting with the top supervisor and regulator, the Federal Reserve, the Securities and Exchange Commission, the FDIC, the controller of the currency, and so on down, including state regulators and supervisors. We were not prepared.
We can't blame this on one party or the other either, can we? Because much of this occurred during the Clinton administration.
That's a very interesting point. That isn't...
Was it the Alan Greenspan administration?
Well, no. It was partly the Alan Greenspan administration. But you have to remember that Alan Greenspan, while he was appointed by a Republican president, he was reappointed by a Democratic president. And it was a Democratic administration that allowed the Glass-Steagall Act to pass out of existence in the 1990s.
And we have, but we have people on both parties loving Alan Greenspan and seeing him as indispensable. I remember when John McCain was running for president in an earlier time, and he said that if Alan Greenspan died, he would prop him up, in, the corpse up in a chair and reappoint him to head the Fed. He's now being blamed for much of what went wrong. How culpable is he?
Well, I would say the blame to a significant measure should be on the Federal Reserve System. Alan Greenspan led the Federal Reserve System for a good part of this period, which we're talking about. Chairman Bernanke came on somewhat later. But Alan Greenspan adhered to a philosophy of economic libertarianism along the lines that I've indicated before, that let the markets adjust what's going on and everything will be taken care of.
And we knew that he took those positions. He was a big admirer of Ayn Rand, for example,
who advocated
those kinds of things.
That's where it came from. But I think there is an underlying aspect to this that pleased everyone. We have to understand that while markets are doing well and while the economy is doing reasonably well, it is difficult for outsiders, for critics, for politicians to prevail with a different view. Moreover, and the average public benefits from the massive debt growth which occurred, from the appreciation in house prices and stock values. So why interfere with something that's very pleasing?
Has Ben Bernanke also been living by economic libertarianism?
For part of his tenure as chairman, yes. I believe the Chairman Bernanke's performance ought to be evaluated in over three time frames. First of all, when Mr. Bernanke came in as chairman in the early part of this decade, he continued to adhere to this approach of economic libertarianism. Secondly, as we moved closer to the crisis, the chairman did not quickly recognize the dimensions of the problem. Once he recognized the problems belatedly, he acted with considerable force and ingenuity.
That's because he is also a scholar of the 1929 Depression. So maybe if finally occurred to him that we were seeing something similar occurring.
Yes, I think belatedly he recognized events that were transpiring were very unusual, but he did not want to recognize them on a very timely basis.
My guest is Henry Kaufman, whose latest book is The Road to Financial Reformation, Warnings, Consequences, Reforms, published by Wiley. I'm sure you know that Mr. Kaufman is the president, has been president since 1988 of Henry Kaufman & Company, an investment management and economic financial consulting firm. He was also with Salomon Brothers for 26 years. And weren't you on the board of Lehman Brothers when it was allowed to fail?
Yes, I was.
Do you believe Lehman Brothers should have been allowed to fail when its competitors were bailed out?
I am really legally restrained from commenting on these issues, but my belief is, to just answer your question on that one point, it should have been bailed out at the time.
Or the alternative might have been to allow Bear Stearns and some of the others to fail?
That is correct.
So it was a matter of inconsistency. Do you have it? And you can't talk about why you think there might have been an inconsistent policy?
My public view on this is that the official regulators failed to understand the dimensions of the involvement of Lehman Brothers in the money and capital markets. And as they began to understand it, it was too late. They understood it after the event occurred of the bankruptcy.
One thesis of your book is that the Federal Reserve missed that financial deregulation still facilitates the creation of debt because it spurs competition and reinforces the drive for new markets and enlarged market standing. Monetary policymakers neither anticipated these realities nor incorporated them into its policy calculations. Can you explain that? Does it mean that it was the Fed that allowed for the banks to become so big that has now become this significant part of the problem?
Yes, it begins with the simple aspect of it, that vast money creation leads to credit creation, debt creation, and that was not well understood by the central bank. For example, securitization, which basically means that you take a debt instrument and you make it from a non-marketable, you move it into a marketable credit instrument. So therefore, you can sell it out into the market to many holders. That loosened the bounds of credit surveillance, because someone who created that debt instrument and then moved it into a marketable form was able to shift the credit to other holders.
Well, 60 Minutes did a report on credit derivatives yesterday that revealed that the legislation specifically protected anyone engaged in the activity from being liable to the gambling and bucket shop laws already on the books. So there were people who were aware of the fact that what was being legislated was against the law and had been against the law for a long, long time.
The incorrect belief was that the market would discipline the participants.
The participants were so smart anyway that they wouldn't make stupid mistakes.
Yes. And credit derivatives was another form of allowing a massive debt creation in the United States. The debt creation was far greater than the increase in, for example, GDP.
But this is not just something that happened in this country. This is something that happened around the world. Were all bankers in a totally delusional state?
Well,
Wall Street and all of the other stock markets around the world?
I would have to say that we were the leaders in the new techniques of credit creation, in the securitization, in the derivatives, in the speed with which households could finance, and the speed with which businesses could acquire debt. We were the leaders in that.
My guest is Henry Kaufman, president of Henry Kaufman & Company, author of On Money and Markets and also Interest Rates, the Markets and the New Financial World. His latest is The Road to Financial Reformation, Warnings, Consequences, Reforms, published by Wiley. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Henry Kaufman. His latest book, The Road to Financial Reformation, Warnings, Consequences, Reforms, published by Wiley. Would you reinstate Glass-Steagall? Would that be one of the reforms?
Well, the question has to be asked, what are we going to do with these very large financial conglomerates, which are much bigger than they were in the 1990s, when, of course, Glass-Steagall disappeared?
So we can't put the genie back in the bottle?
I think it's very difficult to put it back. But then the question has to be asked, what do we do? I think there are two or three solutions to this. One is to make these very large institutions what I would call financial public utilities, and therefore issue a certain number of do's and don'ts of what they can and cannot do, and therefore control very significantly their capital requirements, their profitability. The other aspect of which may be related to the first move is to indicate that these large financial conglomerates cannot engage in certain activities. To illustrate, they probably shouldn't be allowed to do proprietary trading. Now, proprietary trading is that these institutions trade for their own accounts and develop very large, long or short positions that are strictly aimed at generating profits for their own account, having nothing to do with, for example, client relationships. If you have a deposit function within your financial conglomerate, and that deposit function is guaranteed by the FDIC, indirectly, it is a support for this kind of a trading operation. That should not be allowed. If you're underwriting securities, you shouldn't be allowed, for example, to issue reports on that particular issuer of an obligation because there is a potential conflict of interest. If you're in this realm of being too large to fail, you have to be too good to fail, too good to fail, and therefore your capital requirements have to be significantly lifted.
You are in the investment business, investment management. Aren't you going against pretty much everything that all of the other people in your field believe?
Well, I don't know what everybody believes, but I've always felt that my role in when I was managing research and when I still give quite a number of public speeches.
You were in charge of Solomon's research department.
Among other things. And I think it's very important to see it as you see it. That doesn't mean you're going to be in the majority view. Very often a view that ultimately wins out starts off being in a minority view. But I think it's very comforting to be in a majority view because you can be singled out. You cannot be singled out for really being wrong.
You could also could have made a lot more money during the boom years if you were going along with the majority.
Well,
and there's some people who still made a heck of a lot of money from CDs, from credit derivatives.
You have to recognize there's nothing wrong. I was against a lot of junk bond issuance. But there's nothing wrong as long as it is permitted to be a junk bond buyer and to take advantage of what the market provides. I've very often indicated that there are many things that are wrong, and I may have participated in the process.
How would you rate the performance of President Obama's financial team so far? Is it possible to know where we would have been without all of the bank bailouts?
I think if we wouldn't have bailed out those institutions, the financial system and the economic system would be in serious straits today. Those failures would have meant a very serious malfunctioning in the economic system, because our financial institutions are not only domestically linked across our vast country, but they're internationally linked. And the linkages are very intimate and very substantial. And that, for example, the AIG bailout occurred because our authorities knew that if AIG would be allowed to fail, a whole series of other institutions, some of them very prominent, would have been in serious, serious restraint. So I think on that side, the Obama administration recognized the situation and acted wisely. After all, this administration has only been in power since January.
But there seems to be a debate over whether we take the Keynesian approach. And stimulus spending has been much more of a controversial issue.
Well, that is true. I was talking first, of course, on the financial side, on the institutional side. Here you're talking about now the fiscal stimulus itself. Now, my own preference would have been that the president addressed primarily the need to get this economy going again, to make it his first priority, and then delay somewhat the longer-term reviews that are probably needed, as he indicated. But he wanted to deliver, for one reason or another, the whole package, and that, I think, contributed to some problems.
We have a 10-year outlook on deficits hitting a projected $9 trillion. So it looks like we're going to be a debtor nation for a long time. Can we continue to run deficits like these?
Well, first of all, let me indicate, 10-year...
I mean, will there be a market for our debt?
Well, 10-year projections are not very good from a viewpoint of accuracy. I have never seen in my entire financial career where 10-year projections really came close to their mark. They're a lookout. Just ask yourself, standing 10 years ago or 20 years ago, looking ahead 10 years, how well did we perceive the events that ultimately transpired?
I probably wouldn't have said I'd have a cell phone.
There you are.
For example.
Right.
Couldn't have predicted the iPhone and the iPod and all those other things. And
or economically, if you were sitting there.
Credit derivatives. I would have thought they would call gambling.
Exactly. Or in the 1980s, if you were sitting there looking out in the 1990s, in the early 1980s, Japan and Germany were in the forefront of economic growth and stability and so on. The United States was really slogging along. And then as we got into the 1990s, Japan went into a real tailspin. So looking out 10 years is a very dangerous thing.
To a tailspin to the point where they have voted the bums out after all these years.
Right.
My guest is Henry Kaufman. His latest book, The Road to Financial Reformation, Warnings, Consequences, Reforms, published by Wiley. We have a lot of questions from our listeners, but I just want to touch on one other thing which is related to what we've been talking about. There's no foreseeable reversal of the unemployment situation. Won't there be more foreclosures, personal bankruptcies, and defaults on credit cards because of that? What does all the talk about jobless recovery really mean?
Well, you're right. The chances are that the unemployment rate, which is 9.4% or so, and we'll get another number on Friday, will rise. General estimates are between 10 and 10.5%. Now, one of the problems associated with that is, of course, that personal income is going to be restrained. Salaries are going to be restrained. And therefore, when it goes to spending by consumers, it will probably be constrained.
So people won't be getting raises the way they did in the past, and the jobless rate is going to be going up. It's hard to imagine a recovery without new jobs and without people spending, and now there's talk about consumers permanently changing their buying habits.
Well,
I believe that's only until the next boom, and then we forget everything as we have in the past.
Well, I hope we don't forget everything for a number of reasons. First of all, we spend too much over the last 10, 20 years. The savings rate has gone down and went down practically zero. It's now rising again. We cannot permanently have a low savings rate. The low savings rate came about by the huge creation of debt. Why save when you can readily borrow? I think that, for the time being, I think is over. And that means the return to a more normal period, that's difficult. Takes time.
Let me read some of the questions from listeners. James from Brooklyn asks, how can an entity that sets the price of loans instead of allowing market forces to set interest rates be associated with free market libertarianism?
Well, we also moved into, you're talking particularly about the period of Alan Greenspan.
Yeah, the Fed.
We moved into a period in which even the Federal Reserve moved to a kind of a floating rate basis and adjusted interest rates along with market interest rates. That is not necessarily desirable because we created a market in which there are floating interest rates, floating rate for mortgages, for example, and business loans were on prime loan rate were on a floating rate basis very often. That means the institutional arrangement, financial institutions are not constrained as interest rates go up, and thus it contributes to excess debt creation.
Joel from Manhattan says, as long as the banks and financial institutions are able to do leveraging and to, in effect, create bubbles, everything has to play, and the banks will only get larger, so the same thing will happen again.
As stated, that is correct. But the critical issue before Congress and this administration over the next half year will be, how do we reform, how do we re-regulate, how do we supervise financial institutions? How will that differ from what went on over the last two decades?
Another person wants you to talk about the role the ratings companies had in propping this whole thing up.
Well, it is now well known that the rating agencies were overloaded with applications for ratings. It's also known that the system that's involved had conflicts of interest where the borrower, the issuer of securities, paid for the service. The preference would have been, should have been that the user of that rating should have had to pay and not the issuer of the obligations. And as a result, the self-interest dictated the outcome.
Well, doesn't the government bailout of banks ignore the moral hazard issue? Many people have brought that up, but it just gets swept under the rug.
Well, for a long time, the Federal Reserve denied that there's too big to fail. And many of the questions that I raised with some of the officials years ago was that when a large institution gets into trouble, there are certain participants who are punished. For example, the stock price goes down. Number two, the senior management may be replaced with other people. I think what is forgotten in that answer is that before those disciplines are exerted, those institutions have created a huge amount of credit or debt, and that still sits outside.
Tom from Manhattan says, doesn't the problem lie deeper? Hundreds of millions of jobs have gone elsewhere. So isn't that at least as important as trading options? Over 100 million Chinese have gone from poverty to middle class, as an example.
Well, I think the development in Japan and China is very important. I think a related aspect to the question ought to be that we need a more global overview over major financial institutions, whether they are American institutions, European institutions, or Japanese institutions. They're all involved in the same market. Credit and money is fungible.
Another listener, because we really didn't lay it out, wants to know if you can give a brief explanation of what a derivative actually is.
A derivative is a proxy for an underlying credit instrument, whether it is a bond or a stock or a money market obligation.
But it's a way you're gambling for either for prices to go up or prices to go down. And if you gambled for a lot of foreclosures in the real estate market, you made a lot of money, didn't you?
Yes.
Isn't this the same thing as betting for a football team?
Well, it is an instrument where you can use a lot of leverage. And you put a modest amount of money down and you control quite a bit of debt or quite a bit of equity. And that, of course, creates the economic exuberance and financial exuberance and then creates the reverse.
Much of the focus after this whole thing hit was on executive compensation.
Yes.
Do you think that that's where the public outrage should have been addressed?
Well, the focus on compensation is the end product. And the issue is, why did all of these financial participants make so much money? They were able to leverage the trading operation, all kinds of financing operations. They were able to leverage their positions in proprietary trading, which was allowed. But I think the answer is not a matter of legislating what these individuals should receive. That can be constrained considerably by one aspect, and that is raising equity capital requirements substantially.
For the public, it looked like people who had really screwed up were getting a lot of money despite that.
Well, the system that was created that by people who contributed to some of these problems were paid a lot in hindsight. While the process was going on, there was a lot of competition for these people, and there still is to some extent. Unless we learn how to reform this financial system so that those who are engaged in it have a fiduciary responsibility and recognize that has equal weight to their own so-called proprietary intentions.
Do you see any positive signs from Washington? Do you see Congress really understanding what's going on?
Well, there is the beginning of this, but I think we have to understand there are many participants in this process that have so-called vested interests. There are the regulators that want to maintain their authority as it is. There are financial institutions that don't want to be restrained significantly.
Despite the mess that we're in.
There are the legislators who are then pulled in different directions. So it is a very difficult process. In the 1930s, the reformation of the financial markets occurred during the depth of the Depression in 33 and 35.
Henry Kaufman's latest book is The Road to Financial Reformation, Warnings, Consequences, Reforms, published by John Wiley & Sons. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for asking me. We'll be right back.